Hi, thanks for listening to one of our Sunday talks from the Center for Spiritual Living in Midtown Atlanta. If this is your first time listening to one of our talks, we certainly hope you enjoy it. But if you're a regular listener to our podcast, we would like you to consider contributing to our center. It's easy to do. All you have to do is go on our website, and it's easy to find the button and make a contribution. That will allow us to continue bringing these talks to you on a regular basis in the future. Once again, thanks for listening.
It's been an interesting couple days, Friday and Saturday. I'll talk a little bit more about it during the talk, but a little more afterwards. But for right now, I want to continue with what I've been doing this month and done every January for quite a number of years. We're going to talk about week 3 of our January series on the basic principles of spirituality, what I call the basic principles of a teaching that allows us to deal with our spirituality in a practical way. We call it religious science, but it's gotten many names. It's a philosophical, scientific, and spiritual teaching, and it's based on the writings of Dr. Ernest Holmes. I'll talk about him in a minute. But Dr. Holmes was a very interesting man. He felt that a lot of people in the world had become unable to connect with the God of their understanding because they were all caught up in the rules and the rituals and the complicated interpretations of all the sacred writings that separated themselves not only from people in other religions, it frequently separated them from people who were in their own church. In fact, George Bernard Shaw, the great playwright, had a wonderful saying. He once said that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning was the most segregated hour in America, which is very, very interesting. Now, he wasn't talking about gender or racial segregation. He was talking about spiritual segregation. He was addressing the ridiculous belief that God might like some people better than others just because they went to the right church, temple, synagogue, or mosque. So instead, Dr. Holmes took the very common sense approach that spirit doesn't work that way. He said that spirit doesn't do things to us or for us. It does things through us and as us. It does its work using our heart and our mind, not through any book or building, whether we're talking about a Bible and a church, a Torah and a synagogue, or a Quran and a mosque. It was a very novel idea. He took the idea that it's how we deal with each other when we're not in the building or we're not reading the book that's really important. That's what our spirituality should do for us. Anyway, back around 1915 or so, around the time of the First World War, up until his death in 1960, Dr. Holmes began speaking in Western Europe and in the United States, primarily in Los Angeles and New York, to thousands of people about the common spiritual values and truths that exist between all of the great religions. And he did this instead of emphasizing the differences that most people were focusing on, because he knew something that any spiritually educated person would know. He knew that every enlightened individual who ever lived had been saying these same things that he was saying for centuries. Now, to get their point across in the areas where they lived all around the world, these teachers had to use their own words and their own stories and their own cultural experiences, and all of that made their teachings appear different on the surface. But the basic message, the core message, was always the same. God is love. God is life. Be honest and kind, you and me. Don't judge other people. Love your neighbor as yourself. Every single one of those people said all of these things in their own unique way. But sadly, in almost every case, as soon as these wise and wonderful people died, their followers began to change what their teachers had said. Their followers began to exclude other ideas. They began to judge other people. And most important of all, they began to worship their teachers instead of following their teachings. That's how we got in the situation we're in. And the interesting thing is, if those teachers were alive today, whether you're talking about Buddha all the way through Dr. King, not one of them would even recognize what was being done in their name. Not one of them would recognize today what was based on the things that they were supposedly trying to say. Now, over the last couple of weeks, we've talked about the nature of this power, and you can call it God or spirit or Stan or whatever you want to call it, doesn't really matter. We talked about the nature of this power and our individual nature as expressions of it. So the first week, 2 weeks ago, I talked about how God is within us and how this power supports us, not acting as a person above us, looking around and looking down and controlling our life, but as a principle, an invisible principle flowing into the world by means of us. So we talked about the idea that this power, this spirit, has no favorites, it's got no preferences, it's not mysterious, and it's not unpredictable. It's perfectly understandable. It supports everyone equally, regardless of race, gender, nationality, or anything else. And everything about this power, once we understand it, makes perfect sense. And best of all, nobody has to tell us or interpret for us what this power can do, because all we have to do is listen in here, listen to our inner wisdom, to our higher self, and we'll know what the next best thing is to do. That was 2 weeks ago. Then last week, we said that we are the way God works in the world. We said that even though Spirit never punishes us, it does respond to us, and it responds to our thoughts and our beliefs, and it does so in a logical and intelligent way. Which means, like it or not, and a lot of people come here for a few Sundays or whatever, and they leave because they don't like this, we are going to receive in life what we believe we deserve. We're going to get what we expect. We are going to get more of what we think about the most. Now, it's extremely important for us to understand that this is the way that the universe works, because that means if it looks like we are being punished in our life, or that we're not getting the breaks that other people are getting, we don't need to look out there to find some God that we can beg for relief. Because God is only doing what it always does, which is turning our thoughts into things, turning our belief into our reality. All right, it's turning our beliefs about God, our beliefs about ourselves, and our beliefs about the world into our day-to-day experiences. That's why, instead of basking in the glow of being a victim, as so many people do, or praying for a better past, a lot of people do that too, we need to start thinking about what we're thinking about. We need to start looking at what we are actually putting out in terms of our thoughts and our emotions, our beliefs and our energy, so we can figure out why we are attracting the things in our life that we're attracting. And for most people, they're trying to figure out why they are attracting the bad stuff, because they feel they deserve the good stuff. So why am I attracting sickness or poverty or loneliness or failure or whatever it happens to be into my life? Or you could actually think of it this way. This is an analogy I learned many years ago. If we're getting ready to go out for the evening, and we get ourselves all fixed up, and we don't like what we see in the mirror, the answer is not to go get a better-looking or better-dressed mirror. Right? Makes sense. If we don't like the number that we see on the scale when we stand on it, the answer is not to keep looking around till we find a scale that feels sorry for us. That's not the answer, okay? You see, the universe is too intelligent to give us what we say we want if we aren't willing to do our part to make it happen. So the best answer is always for us to make a conscious and deliberate change, not in what we're looking at out there, but in what we are thinking about and feeling in here. All right? About the way we're thinking, about the way we're living, so that this power that's working through us has something better to work with. We need to give God something better to work with. Now, the good news is, once we decide to accept complete personal responsibility, let me say that again, complete personal responsibility for what we're putting out, then everything we need to make a change is already there. It's ready for us to use it, only now in a different way, to create a different result in our life that reflects a better idea. That's really what I'm going to expand on today. Now, the title of my talk is What God Really Does. And if I was really lazy, which I am not, I could just say everything and we could all go to brunch. It'd be nice and easy. Because that's the real answer. It really has to be. This power does everything. I mean, think about it. It not only created everything out of itself, but it's also completely present in, as, and through its creation. So nothing can happen outside of it. Now, Dr. Holmes says it this way. This is what we might call the book answer. In this section, he said, God is the omnipresent, everywhere present, creative intelligence, working through laws of its own being, creating all things within itself. That's the book answer. Sounds a little esoteric, but that's what it is. But what I want to talk about today is the fact that we have to understand what this power does before we can use it in an intelligent way, which is what we're going to talk about next week with how to use it. And one of the first things I want to talk about is this idea of an infinite intelligence functioning in what appears to us to be a limited world. Because that, when you start talking about spirituality, which wanders into religion, brings up a very logical question, which is this. If this power has the ability to create peace and health and prosperity and all of those wonderful things in the world without limit, then why hasn't it done so already, if it's so intelligent? Which is actually a very good question, especially if it's supposed to be supporting us. I mean, if God has the power to stop wars, to feed the hungry, to house the homeless, to end all suffering, and to heal all despair, then why has he, she, or it not already done it? And while we're at it, why don't most of us have a better job, more money, a better body, and a perfect relationship? While we're, going, why not? Okay? I mean, this power is supposed to be supporting me, right? Is it because I don't deserve it? No. Is it because God doesn't think we're worth it? Are we being tested? Are we being ignored? Are we being punished? Those are all good questions. But throughout history, humankind has been asking those questions and coming up with a lot of different answers. They call them religions, but that's what they are. And most of those answers reflect a very low opinion both of God and the human race. So Dr. Holmes, being the intelligent person he was, looked at this age-old question about why this infinite intelligence hasn't already fixed all the world's problems on its own, and he came up with a very profound but simple answer. And he said this, I'll read it, so just bear with me for a moment and we'll talk about it. He said, while it is true that we are immersed in an infinite intelligence and a mind that knows all things, it is also true that this intelligence can acquaint us with its ideas only as we are able and willing to receive them. And then he says, it can only tell us what we understand. It can only tell us what we understand. Now, think for a moment about what that means. Even if the solution to every problem we encounter in the world or in our individual lives, if the solution is immediately at hand, which it is, by the way, but that's another story, we can only use as much of this power as we can recognize and comprehend. So he said, even though it's the nature of the universe to give us everything, which it does and has been doing since time began, it's our nature to look at the universe and to discover, to accept, to understand, and to use everything that we've been given, even if we don't yet know that it exists. Now, this idea takes a little bit of a stretch, not because it doesn't make sense, but because it's not the way we're used to thinking about God. Because we have been conditioned, that's the word really, to think about God as something hidden, something outside of science that does things in its own mysterious ways that we poor mortals can't understand. But once we shift to this new enlightened way of thinking, that isn't the case at all. You see, every single one of us are what the old religious people used to call spirit incarnate. We're the Word made flesh. We see those words in all the Christian writings. We are the invisible made visible, which is a little closer to what I like, which means we are capable of knowing virtually everything about the universe because we are an integral part of it. And what we call our mind is the mind we share with the one mind that we call God. So whenever we think about this universal power, we need to think of it instead of as a mystery to be solved. We need to think of it as an open and available frontier, totally infinite, of knowledge and creative opportunity that we are being encouraged to explore instead of something we have to struggle to understand. That's a totally different relationship. The key is God does not set things in motion without our cooperation. whether that cooperation is conscious or unconscious. Therein lies the rub, kind of, what Shakespeare said. The universal law has already provided all the natural laws we need to create whatever we want to create, but we are the ones who have to start the process by using those laws. And in using them, we place a demand on the universe, which means we put a demand on these laws for a specific purpose. Now, this is the most natural thing in the world. If you think of it like electricity in our house, how many people have electricity in your house? Several. Okay, very good. I love living in Atlanta, don't you? Thank God we're not Alabama. Anyway, was that my outside voice? I'm sorry. We have learned as a race to use the power of electricity, which is a natural law, and it's invisible. Has anyone ever seen electricity? No, but we see what it does. Okay. To create an environment using available things like wires and fixtures and switches and all that, where we have access to this power whenever we want. When we're home, we're totally surrounded in it. Now, with all the wireless stuff, we got it everywhere you happen to be. But in order to use it and to accomplish what we want to accomplish, we have to plug in something or we have to turn something on. So we have to make some kind of a demand on this power. But I say a demand instead of a request because we don't request electricity to do something for us. We ask it to do, we make a demand for it to do what it already does. So if we plug in a lamp, we get light. And if we don't get light, it's not because the electricity doesn't like us or it's mad at us. We check it. There are natural ways to check it. Change the light bulb, check the plug, whatever it happens to be. If we plug in a heater, we expect same electricity, right? We plug in a heater. What do we expect to get? Heat. You plug in a blender. What do you expect? Daiquiris. Somebody, whatever it happens to be. Okay. Of course, if we plug in our finger, what do we expect to get? Shocked. Not because it's mad at us, okay? Because that's what electricity does. You place a demand, it launches the electricity into whatever we put into it. So it will do for us whatever we want it to do, but we've got to give it some direction. We have to give it some direction. And the result will always be a perfect response to whatever demand we make upon it. Now, how does this fit in with our idea of God as a loving and supportive power? All the same. It's a power that surrounds us. We place a demand, and it responds to us according to the demand. You see, all the mental and spiritual laws have existed since time began, whether we knew about them or not. Kennedy, my teacher, used to say that the Hebrews could have flown a 747 out of Egypt instead of schlepping around for 40 years if they'd known how. Everything they needed was there. They just didn't know how to put it together. All right? So all these invisible laws have visible effects, and they always have once we've learned how to use them. All right? The only difference between the spiritual laws and the physical laws that we use to make things like computers and cars and stuff is that most people think that the physical laws are real because they can see them. And they don't think the spiritual laws are real at all. But the law of attraction is just as real as the law of aerodynamics. The law of abundance is just as real as the law of gravity. Metaphysics and quantum physics. Metaphysics simply means beyond what we see, beyond the physical. They're showing us, that the laws of the invisible universe are just as real as the other laws we use. They're all here for our benefit, and they'll always do what they're designed to do for anyone who uses them intelligently. We don't have to deserve them. We don't have to beg for them to work, and they aren't being hidden. Oh, thank you very much. So, where are we? Anyway, here's something else to remember. The laws themselves don't do anything. We do. That's how we have to learn how they work. All right? So, we are this power at work in the world doing exactly what it does, which is endlessly creating new and better ways to live. Now, in the Old Testament, I know some of you grew up with that, many of you, Proverbs 4, verse 7, and I say that because somebody always asks me after the talk. There's a beautiful and a very powerful verse, whether you're a Bible person or not. And it says, "Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom. And with all thy getting," can anybody finish that? Get understanding. Get understanding. That's a very profound statement. Every step that humankind has taken, whether it's in the area of science or medicine or technology or human relations, whether it's a worldwide shift or a change in our individual life, every major change has started out as an idea. As an idea. Let me use one very recent example, near and dear to our hearts here in Atlanta. This past Monday, we celebrated the birthday and the life of a man who was a perfect example of everything that I'm talking about this morning. His entire life was a story of ideas manifesting, of spiritual growth and evolution unfolding, completely unfolding. And I find it incredibly interesting that the events of this Friday and Saturday happened during the week when we celebrate Dr. King's birthday. Very, very interesting. The world that Dr. King was born into, and many of you were there during the time that he was with us, it was a world with a very limited understanding about what constituted the divine laws, because they are, of justice and human rights and equality. Now, it had been that way for a long time. The world had been that way for a long time, and a lot of people were used to it, even people who suffered under it. But people were afraid of change. They were afraid of change. They felt threatened. Even though the change would make things better, they felt threatened. And it took the wisdom and the awareness and the courage of some very spiritually grounded people like Dr. King and a lot of other people who were with him on that path to show the world not only how small its thinking had become, but to show the world how great it could be. In the march yesterday, that's what we need to focus on. Not what this march was showing about how small the world's thinking is, but how great it can be. That's the part we need to get out of it. But I want to point out here that everything that Dr. King accomplished, all the faith and the awareness and the strength that flowed out from him to touch people, not just around him, but everywhere in the world of every race, color, and creed, all started out as an idea. It all started out as an idea. It started with a belief that the world, not just one part of it or one race or one country, but the world was ready for something better. He was ready for something better. Now, this wasn't just his idea. There were some amazing men and women who had had this same idea many times in the years before. But he was the one who took that idea, along with those who helped him, and tapped into the power of spirit, the power of life, the power of possibility, whatever you want to call it, and saw what the future could hold, and he set the law in motion. He set this entire movement in motion, and we have people doing that for every movement that has ever changed humankind. That's why I believe when he said, "I have been to the mountaintop," that was actually not just a metaphor, it was a logical, intelligent, and spiritual expression of the truth. In consciousness, he had in fact been there. Robert Goddard, who was a great scientist and space pioneer, had a quote around that time. He said, "It is difficult to say what is impossible because the dream of yesterday is the hope of today and the reality of tomorrow." That's what we're talking about. The dream of yesterday is the hope of today and the reality of tomorrow. There's no doubt at all that Dr. King understood the relationship between spirituality and science, too. Many of his quotes, many of you are familiar with him. In fact, he once said, "Science investigates, religion interprets." Great. He said, "Science gives us knowledge, which is power, but religion gives us wisdom, which is control." Control over that power. He also said, and keep this in mind with what's been going on over the last couple of days, "We must keep our moral and spiritual progress abreast with our scientific and technological advances." He said, "The great problem confronting us today is that we have allowed the means by which we live to outdistance the ends for which we live. We have allowed our civilization to outrun our culture, so we are in danger now of ending up with guided missiles in the hands of misguided men." A very powerful and relevant statement here. All right? Now, at first, one idea doesn't do much. After all, it's only an idea. But once that idea starts spawning and giving birth to other ideas, and we start to see all the different ways that that one idea can become real and all the different ways it can grow, we start to get excited and we start to get passionate. And then we start to get involved, which is what people are starting to do. And that's when things start to happen. When we put our own creative power and energy into the law and allow it to manifest. That's what happened, if you're a student of history, as I am, in Western Europe during what we call the Renaissance. You know, the Renaissance was only about a 50-year period following 800 years of darkness in Western Europe. And during that 50-year period, when the Western world moved from the Dark Ages to what we call the Age of Enlightenment, amazing things happened. The printing press starting to spread books and knowledge across countries. The Protestant Reformation. Magellan traveling around the world. Da Vinci, Galileo, Michelangelo. All of these people. The whole world transformed itself through the power of ideas. All these ideas happening in the same period. But except for the number of people involved, the Renaissance is no different from any Renaissance that happens in your life or in mine. Because they're both the creative process at work, starting with an idea and working through law. Starting with an idea, but working through the law. If we are sufficiently open, and that's what we come here for on Sunday, what we read for, all these things. If we are sufficiently open, when we bring a brand new idea into our life, we will, if we're open, we will immediately begin to see more and more what was always possible for us, only we didn't realize it. I mean, it's not that we weren't smart enough before or we weren't capable enough. It's just that our level of awareness and our willingness to be open always has to expand to a certain point before our ability to create has room to maneuver. Our awareness of what's possible for us, whether it's for us personally or for the human race at large, has to get bigger before we can accomplish more than we ever did before. Great example I heard years ago, it's kind of like a snail, okay? Or a lobster or a crustacean, whatever you want to call it, but think of a snail. You know, a snail's shell doesn't grow. It's fixed, like some people's minds, like ideas. It's the living, intelligent part inside the shell that wants to grow. It wants to grow. But it can't get any bigger until it gets more room. Until it gets more room. So when the life inside the shell tries to grow and the pressure of the shell starts to squeeze in because it's too small for this intelligence to expand, the living creature either creates a bigger space by crawling outside and creating a new one, or it dies. Or it dies. Now, some people spend their whole life living inside the same shell. Their whole life, the same locked ideas. They put a self-imposed limit on their growth. They refuse to allow a new idea anywhere near them. They stifle their desires. They shut out their dreams. And what happens? They die. They still may be walking around. They still may be talking. But mentally and spiritually, they might just as well be dead. But for those of us who choose to set out on a spiritual path, that kind of behavior doesn't work anymore. It doesn't for me, and I know for many of you it doesn't either. The Sufi poet Rumi, I'm a great fan of his, 900 years ago, his poetry, he said, "Some souls are content with just longing. I am not one of them. Some souls are content with just hoping things will get better. I am not one of them." That's a powerful affirmation. For some of us, once we've been in this teaching for a while, if we reach a stagnation point in our job or our relationship or our financial situation, whatever it is, something inside of us insists on growing. Something that we have fed and nurtured insists on growing, and we've learned that we can't ignore it. We can no longer ignore it. Some people call this spiritual discontent, which is a great phrase. I just call it spiritual maturity, which is even better. When we feel this way, all we're feeling is this power of life that is a part of us and we are a part of it, trying to express itself as us. And this power feeds on passion. It feeds on wisdom. It feeds on intelligence. And it has to continue growing or it will die. It will, in fact, die. And eventually, if we're going to survive, we're going to have to leave the safety of our old familiar home, hometown maybe, or old familiar job or relationship or whatever it is, and we're probably scared to death. But that's okay. There's nothing wrong with being scared. You can grow right through that. I've done it, and so have you. Now, fortunately, the same desire that we have to grow and to live life in a better way is what helps us to tap into the intelligence of the universe that knows what it needs to do. And before we know it, we find ourselves living in a bigger space, in a shell that, for the time being, is bigger than the one we had before, and the process starts all over again. Now, if we believe this, if we take this spiritual belief as our own and we live our lives in accordance with this belief, our growth can't help but happen. It can't help but happen in whatever area we're dealing with. Dr. Holmes once made the statement in the beginning of the textbook, whatever mind can conceive, we can achieve. Whatever our mind can conceive, wrap our mind around, we can achieve. And we've all seen it happen time and again. Because the gifts we need have already been given many times over, and all we have to do is accept them with gratitude and to use them with love, intelligence, and faith. And that is what the God in us really does. And next week we're going to finish this series by bringing it all together in a talk about how to use it, meaning how to use this power in a practical way in our life. This is the truth in your life, and this is the truth in mine, and so it is. And so it is. All right. Thank you. Instead of doing a treatment now based on the talk, I think we covered that pretty well. I want us all to take a moment and really think about our state of mind over the last couple days. Because when we see things happening that have a strong emotional content, we need to decide where we're going to focus our mind. And the best place to focus your mind, as Emmett Fox once said, is don't think about the problem, think about God. So I will simply state, before I go into the treatment, into the affirmative prayer, that with all that's been going on, much of our media, for better or worse, is focusing on the drama, on the negativity of all of it. In the march, in the inauguration, in all of these things, there are people on what we will call both sides, though God has no side, there are people who are taking the high road. There are people who are using this wisdom that we're talking about to create the world in a better way. And that's what we need to focus on. So join with me now in recognizing this truth. I know that God is omnipresent, not just as a power or a thing, but as every man, woman, and child on the planet. I know that the intelligence that flows through the mind and the consciousness of every person is one and the same intelligence, and it is shaped only by our thoughts and beliefs and our experience. So I have complete control over the thoughts that stay in my mind. I may not be able to control what comes in, but I can certainly decide if I'm going to keep it. So I pledge to myself, to my higher self, this moment, from this moment on, to accept and to keep in my mind thoughts of love and peace and balance, and joy, and life. All these words that I know are divine words, and I set aside the lower words and give them no attention. I know that we are all better than we appear to be, especially in this time of great national turmoil, and I am going to be the best me that I can be. I'm going to be the most tolerant, the most open, the least judgmental, and the most loving person I can to every person, including those who disagree with me. I give this freely, this feeling of joy, this recognition of the greatness of spirit to everyone I meet. I don't poison my mind with negative ideas. I stay above them, beyond them. I transcend them. And I allow myself to be in the world, not as part of the problem, but as part of the solution. So knowing this, I give thanks. I give thanks for this great country that I live in, for this great planet made of so many wonderful countries and people. I give thanks for all those who have the wisdom to rise above the fear and the anger and the negativity. And I allow myself to be one of them. I give thanks for the future that I know can be incredibly wonderful in spite of what we see or think right now. I give an opening in my mind, in my heart, and in the world for every single one of us to be the best we can be. This is my truth, whether I'm watching television, reading the news, or speaking with others. This is the spiritual ground that I stand upon, and it is rock solid. Knowing this, I expect the best, accept the best, and bring the best. This is my truth. I embrace it, and I place this idea firmly into consciousness, knowing that it will go forth and do its perfect work. Please join me in saying, and so it is.